One from the wedding arrived at the same time. A couple of half-assed guards floating, but generally at these affairs they like to keep a low profile. I saw cameras all around, Rawley pressed. They must have some film. That's what I'm hoping, said McBride. I'll introduce you to Sharp, head of security. We can go over that now. Andrew Sharp was a trim, wiry man with a square chin and narrow, colorless lips. He looked scared. A day ago, he had a fairly cushy job, but now the police and the FBI were all over him. Having to explain things to two outside cops from San Francisco didn't help matters. He brought us into his office, popped a Marlboro Light out of a pack, and looked at Rawley.
I got a meeting with the executive director in about 8 minutes.
We didn't even bother to sit down. I asked, did your guards notice anyone unusual?
300 guests, Madam Detective. Everyone congregated in the entrance atrium. My staff doesn't usually get involved in a whole lot, except to make sure no one with too much to drink gets too close to the exhibits.
What about how he got out, then? Sharp wheeled around in his chair, pointing to a blow-up diag of the museum's layout.
Either the main entrance here, where you came in, or one we left open off the back veranda. It leads down to the lake walk. There's a cafe there during the summer. Mostly it's blocked off, but the families wanted it open.
Two shots fired, I said. No one heard anything?
It was supposed to be a high-class crowd. You think they want my guards milling around? We keep 2-3 guys to make sure overzealous guests don't wander into restricted areas. I should have guards patrolling the corridors down by the restrooms? What are you going to take, toilet paper?
Security cameras? Rawley asked. Sharp sighed.
We've got the exhibition halls covered, of course. The main exits, a remote sweep of the main hall, but nothing on the corridor where the shooting took place. Nothing in the crapper. Anyway, the police are scanning tape with members of each family as we speak. It would make it a hell of a lot easier if we knew who the hell we're looking for.
I reached into my briefcase and took out a copy of a bare-bones artist's sketch. It showed a thin face with a jutting chin, hair combed back, and a lightly shaded goatee. Why don't we start with him? Chapter 56. McBride had to be back in the office for a press briefing on the investigation. I needed to figure out why the killer had come to Cleveland, and what, if any, connections there were to our murders back in San Francisco. The next step was to talk to the parents of the bride. Shaker Heights was a posh, upper-end suburb in the height of midsummer bloom. On every street, green lawns led up to graceful, tree-sheltered homes. One of McBride's men drove me out while Rawley went back to the lakefront Hilton to meet with the family of the groom. The Kogut's home was a warm, red-brick Normandy under a canopy of tall oaks. I was met at the door by the older sister of the bride, who introduced herself as Hillary Bloom. She sat me down in a comfy, picture-filled den. Books, large-screen TV, pictures of the two of them as kids, weddings. Kathy was always the rebellious one, Hillary explained. A free spirit. It took her a while to find herself, but she was just settling down. She had a good job, a publicist for a firm in Seattle, where she met James. She was just coming around.
Coming around from what? I asked.
Like I said, she was a free spirit. That was Kathy. Her parents, Hugh and Christine Kogut, came into the room. I witnessed the glazed, bewildered shock of people whose lives had been shattered.
She was always in and out of relationships, her mother eventually admitted, but she also had a passion for life.
She was just young, her father said. Maybe we spoiled her too much. She always had an urge to experience things.
In her pictures, the wispy red hair and dare-me eyes, I could see the same joy for life the killer had obviously seen in his first two victims. It made me feel sad, weary. "Do you know why I'm here?" I finally asked. The father nodded.
"To determine if there was any connection to those other horrible crimes out west."
"So, can you tell me, did Kathy have any connection to San Francisco?"
I could see a cast of grim recognition creep its way onto their faces.
"After college, for a few years, she did live there," her mother said.
"She went to UCLA," her father said. "For a year or so, she stayed in Los Angeles, tried to catch on with one of the studios. She started out with a temp job at Fox. Then she got this publicity job in San Francisco, covering music. It was a very fast life. Parties, promotions, no doubt a lot worse. We weren't happy, but for Kathy, she thought it was her big break.
She lived in San Francisco.
I asked if they'd ever heard of Melanie Weil or Rebecca Passano. They shook their heads. What about any relationships that might have ended badly? Someone who, out of jealousy or obsession, might have wanted to do her harm? Recklessness always seemed like a basis for Kathy's relationships, Hillary said with an edge.
I did warn her.
Her mother shook her head. She always wanted to do things on her terms. Did she ever mention anyone special from the time she lived in San Francisco? Everyone looked at Hillary.
No, no one special.
No one stands out. She lived there for a while. She didn't keep up with anyone after she left.
I seem to remember her saying she still went down there every once in a while, her father said, on business.
Old habits are hard to crack, Hillary smirked with a tightening of her lips. There had to be some connection, some contact from the years she had spent there. Someone came all the way here to see her dead. What about anyone from San Francisco invited to the wedding? I asked.
There was one girlfriend, her father said.
Merrill, said her mother. Merrill Cole. Shortly now. I think she's at the Hilton, if she's still here.
I pulled out the artist's sketch we had of the killer's possible appearance. I know it's rough, but do you know this man? Someone who knew Kathy? Did you see anyone like this at the wedding? One by one, the Koguts shook their heads. I got up to go. I told them if anything came to mind, regardless of how small or insignificant, to get in touch with me. Hillary walked me to the door.
There is one more thing, I said. I knew it was a long shot. By any chance, did Kathy buy her wedding dress in San Francisco?
Hillary looked at me blankly and shook her head.
No, from a vintage shop in Seattle.
At first, the answer deflated me. But then, in a flash, I saw that this was really a connection I was looking for. The first two murders had been committed by someone stalking his victims from afar. That's why he found them in the way he did, tracked them. But this one, Kathy, she had been chosen in a different way. I was certain that whoever had done this had known her. Chapter 57. I drove straight to the Hilton on Lakeshore Boulevard and was able to catch Merrill shortly just as she was about to depart for the airport. She turned out to be stylish, maybe 27, with shoulder-length chestnut-brown hair tied back in a bun.
A group of us were up all night, she said, apologizing for the swollen lines around her face. I'd like to stay on, but who knows when they'll finally release the body. I have a 1-year-old.
The Koguts told me you live in San Francisco.
She sat on the edge of the bed across from me. Los Altos. I moved down 2 years ago when I got married.
I need to know about Kathy Kogut in San Francisco, I explained. Lovers, breakups, someone who might have a cause to do this.
You think she knew this madman?
Her face was clenched. Maybe, Merrill. You can help us decide. Will you help?
Kathy hooked up with guys, Merrill said after a pause. She was always free about things in that way.
Are you saying she was promiscuous?
If you want to see it in that way. Men liked her. There was a lot of energy going on back then. Music, film, alternative stuff. Whatever made her feel alive.
I was getting the picture.
Does that include drugs? Like I said, whatever made her feel alive. Yes, Kathy did recreational drugs.
Merrill, though pretty, had the hard-edged face of a street survivor who had remade herself as a soccer mom. Anyone come to mind who might have wanted to hurt her? Someone who was overly fascinated, maybe jealous when she moved on? Merrill thought a bit, shook her head.
I don't think so.
You two were close? She nodded, at the same time her eyes hooded. Why did she move away?
She landed a great job. Must have seemed like she was finally climbing the ladder. Her father and mother always wanted that, the Shaker Heights thing. Look, I really have to catch a plane.
What are the chances Kathy was running away from something? You live the way we lived, you're always running from something. Merrill shortly shrugged and looked bored.
There was an attitude, a coldness about Merrill I didn't like. She still surrounded herself with the cynical aura of a dissolute past, and I had the suspicion she was withholding something.
"So what you do, Merrill? Marry the dimebag Mambo King of Silicon Valley?"
She shook her head. Finally, she smiled thinly. "Fund manager." I leaned forward.
"So you don't remember anyone special? Someone she might have kept up with, been scared of?"
"Those years," Merrill shortly said, "I have a hard time remembering anyone special at all."
"This was your friend," I said, my voice rising. "You want me to show you what she looks like now?"
Merrill stood up, stepped over to the dresser, and began to pack a leather bag with toiletries and makeup. At some point she stopped and caught a glimpse of herself in the mirror. Then she looked over her shoulder and caught my eye.
"Maybe there was this one guy Kathy was into. Big shot. Older. She said I'd know who he was, but she wouldn't give me a name. I think she met him through the job. As I remember, he was married. I don't know how it ended, or who ended it, or if it ever did."
My adrenaline began to flow.
"Who is he, Merrill? He might have killed your friend."
She shook her head.
"You ever see this man?"
She shook her head again. I pushed on.
"You're the one friend from back then she invites to her wedding, and you never met him once? You don't even know a name?"
She gave me a cool smile.
"She was protective. She didn't tell me everything. Scout's honor, Inspector. I assume he was a public figure."
"You see her much in the past couple of years?"
Merrill shook her head again. "She was being a real bitch. New money in Silicon Valley."
"Her father told me she still used to come to town on business."
Merrill shrugged.
"I don't know. I have to go."
I yanked open my bag and removed one of the crime scene photos McBride had given me, the one of Kathy, wide-eyed, slumped in a bloody heap in front of her husband.
"Someone she knew did this. You want to be met at the plane and thrown in a holding cell as a material witness? You can call in your husband's lawyer, but it'll still take him 2 days to get you out. How would the tech fund crowd react to that news? I'm sure I could get it in the Chronicle."
Merrill turned away from me, her chin quivering.
"I don't know who it was. Just that he was older, married, some big-time SOB. Kinky, and not nice about it. Kathy said he played sex games on her. But whoever he was, she was always quiet about it, protective. The rest, you'll have to do on your own."
"She still continued to see this guy, didn't she?"
I was starting to put it together.
"Even after she moved to Seattle, even after she met her husband."
She gave me the slightest smile.
"Good guess, Inspector. Right up to the end."
"How close to the end?"
Merrill shortly picked up the phone.
"This is 402, checking out. I'm in a rush."
She stood up, slung a Prada bag over her shoulder, an expensive-looking raincoat over her arm. Then she looked at me and said dryly,
"To the very end."
Chapter 58.
"No wonder the bride didn't wear white," Raleigh frowned and said as I told him about my interview with Merrill shortly.
McBride had set us up for dinner at Nonni's, an Italian place on the lake, a short walk from our hotel. Raleigh's interview with the groom's parents had yielded nothing eventful. James Voskuhl had been an aspiring musician who had floated on the edge of the music scene in Seattle, finally hooking his way into representing a couple of upcoming bands. He had no known connection to San Francisco.
"The killer knew Kathy," I said.
"How else would he find her here? They had a relationship."
"Right up to the end," he mused.
"To the very end," I answered, "meaning maybe here in Cleveland."
These weren't choir girls. Merrill said this guy was older, married, kinky, predatory. It fits the pattern of the murders. Someone she knew in San Francisco must have seen Redbeard.
Somebody knows.
Merrill claims that Kathy was protecting her lover, possibly because he was a celebrity.
You think this Merrill shortly has more to add?
Maybe.
Or the family.
I got the feeling they were holding something back. He had ordered a 97 Chianti, and when it came, he tilted his glass.
"Here's to David and Melanie, Michael and Becky, James and Kathy."
"Let's toast them when we catch this pathetic bastard," I said. It was the first time we'd been alone in Cleveland, and suddenly I was nervous. We had an entire evening to fill, and no matter how we kept steering back to the case or joking how this wasn't a date, there was this pull, this bass chord twanging inside me, telling me that this was no time to start anything with anyone, not even handsome and charming Chris Raleigh. Then why had I changed into a baby blue sweater and nice slacks instead of staying with the chambray shirt and khakis I'd worn all day? We ordered. I had osso buco, spinach, a salad. Raleigh, a veal paillard. "Maybe it was someone on her job," Raleigh said, "or connected with her job." I told Jacoby to check out her firm in Seattle. Her father said she still came down to San Francisco on business. I want to see if that's the case. And if it isn't, then either she was hiding something, or they are. He took a sip of wine. Why would she go through with a wedding if she was still involved with this guy? I shrugged. They all said Kathy was finally settling down. I'd like to see what she was like back then, if this is what they meant by settling down. I was thinking that I wanted another crack at the sister, Hillary. I remembered something she had said. Old habits are hard to crack. I had thought she was talking about drugs, parties. Did she mean Redbeard? McBride tells me tomorrow morning we should be able to review some film at the museum. The guy was there, Raleigh, I said with certainty. He was there that night. Kathy knew her killer. We just have to find out who he is. Raleigh poured a little more wine into my glass. We're partners now, aren't we, Lindsay? Sure, I said, a little surprised by the question. Can't you tell I trust you? I mean, we've been through 3 double murders. We're committed to seeing it through. I backed you up with Mercer. I even helped clean up after dinner at your place.
Yeah? So?
I smiled, but his face had a cast of seriousness to it. I was trying to figure out where he was going. What do you say? Maybe it's about time you started calling me Chris. Chapter 59. After dinner, Chris and I walked down by the tree-lined lakefront toward our hotel. A cool, misty breeze lapped at my face. We didn't say much. That same nervous apprehension was tingling on the surface of my skin. Occasionally our arms brushed. He had his jacket off, and there was a solid outline to his shoulders and arms. Not that I was noticing superficial things like that. "It's still early," he said. 5:30 our time," I replied. "I could still catch Roth. Maybe I should bring him up to date." Raleigh grinned. "You already called Jacoby. I bet he was probably in Roth's office before he hung up the phone." As we walked, it was as if this unbearable force were pulling me close, then pushing me away. "Anyway," I said, "for once, I don't feel like calling in."
"What do you feel like?" Raleigh asked.
"Why don't we just walk?"
"The Indians are playing. You want to sneak our way in? Must be the 5th inning."
"We're cops, Raleigh."
"Yeah, that would be bad. You want to dance, then?"
"No," I said, even firmer. "I don't want to dance." Every word seemed charged with a hidden electric message. "What I'm starting to feel like," I turned to him, "is that I'm having a hard time remembering to call you Chris."
"And what I'm starting to feel like," he answered, facing me, "is I'm having a hard time trying to pretend that nothing's going on."
"I know," I murmured breathlessly, "but I just can't."
It sounded really stupid, but as much as I wanted him, there was a greater hesitation inside holding me back.
"I know, but I just can't. What does that mean?"
"It means I'm feeling things, too, and that part of me wants to go with those feelings. But right now, I just don't know if I can. It's complicated, Chris."
Every nerve in my body was on alert. We found ourselves walking again, the breeze from the lake suddenly cooling the sweat that had broken out on my neck.
"You mean it's complicated because we're working together?"
"That," I lied. I dated guys on the force once or twice.
"That, and what else?" Raleigh said.
1,000 desires inside me were screaming to give in. What was going through my mind was crazy. I wanted him to touch me, and I didn't. We were alone on the waterfront. At that moment, if he held me, if he bent and kissed me,
I didn't know what I would do. I do want to, I said, my fingers reaching for his hand, staring into his deep blue eyes.
You're not telling me everything, he said.
It took everything I had to hold off confessing. I don't know why I didn't. A deep part of me wanted him to want me, and to keep thinking I was strong. I could feel the heat from his body, and I thought he could feel the wavering resolve in mine. I just can't right now, I said softly.
You know, I won't always be your partner, Lindsay.
I know that. And maybe I won't always be able to say no.
I don't know if I was disappointed or relieved to see our hotel up ahead. Part of me wanted to run to my room, throw open the windows, and just breathe in the night air. I was sort of happy I wouldn't have to make that decision, when Raleigh took me by surprise.
He leaned over without warning and pressed his lips on mine. The kiss was so soft, as if he were gently asking, "Is this okay?"
I let the kiss linger warmly.
Soft hands, soft lips.
It wasn't as if I hadn't imagined this happening. It was just as I had imagined.
I wanted to be in control, but here it was, out of the blue, and I was giving in. But just as I was starting to give him myself, the fear caught up to me. The fear of the inescapable truth. I dropped my head, slowly pulled away.
That was nice. For me, anyway, Raleigh said, resting his forehead against mine. I nodded, but said,
I can't, Chris.
Why are you always holding back, Lindsay? He asked.
I wanted to say, because I am deceiving you, tell him everything that was going on. But I was content to deceive, though I did it with the greatest yearning I had felt in years. I just want to nail Redbeard, I answered.
Chapter 60. The next morning, Detective McBride left a message for us to meet him in Sharp's office at the Hall of Fame. Something had come back on the film. In a sparsely decorated conference room, the museum's security chief, McBride, and several members of the CPD homicide staff sat facing a widescreen video monitor on a walnut cabinet.
At first, Sharp began self-importantly, we were just randomly going through the tape with members of the families, stopping on anyone who didn't look familiar. Your sketch, he turned to me, helped narrow it down.
He flicked a handheld controller toward the screen.
The first clips you're going to see are the main entrance.
The screen lit up, standard black-and-white surveillance footage. It was so weird and strange. Several gaudily dressed guests seemed to be arriving at once, many of them outfitted as famous rockers. One was Elton John. His date had teased hair dyed in various light and dark shades, Cyndi Lauper style. I recognized a Chuck Berry, a Michael Jackson, a couple of Madonnas, Elvis Costello's.
Sharp fast-forwarded, the film advancing like individual edited stills. An older couple arrived dressed in traditional evening wear. Behind them, almost tucked into their backs, came a man who was clearly shying from the camera, averting his face.
There,
Sharp said.
I saw him. My heart pumped madly in my chest. God damn Redbeard!
It was a horrible, grainy likeness. The man, sensing the direction of the camera, quickly hurried by. Maybe he had come there earlier, scouting for security cameras. Maybe he was just smart enough to avoid a direct shot. Whatever it was, he sneaked into the crowd and disappeared. A ball of anger knotted in my chest.
Can you back up, home in? I said to Sharp. I need to see his face.
He leveled his remote and the image channeled into a higher magnification. I stood up. I was staring at a partially obscured shot of the killer's face. No eyes, no clear feature, only a shadowy profile, a jutting chin, and the outline of a goatee. There was no doubt in my mind that this was the killer. I didn't know his name, I could barely see his face, but the fuzzy image I had first sketched together in my mind with Claire was now in front of me.
Is that the best you can do? Raleigh pressed.
A member of the museum tech staff replied, Might be able to get it technologically enhanced. On this rough footage, this is what we have.
We pick him up again later on, Sharp said.
He quickly fast-forwarded and stopped at a wide-angle view of the main hall, the wedding reception. They were able to zoom in on the same tuxedoed man standing at the edge of the crowd, observing. When the image was magnified, though, it became grainy and lost its resolution.
He's purposely avoiding looking at the camera,
I whispered to Raleigh. He knows where they are.
We ran these shots by both families, Sharp said. No one places him. No one can identify who he is. I mean, there's a chance it's not him, but considering your sketch...
It's him, I said firmly. My eyes burned on the grainy screen. I was also sure we were looking at Kathy Voskuhl's mysterious lover. Chapter 61 Hillary knew. I was almost sure of it. But why she would conceal such a thing related to her sister's death, I couldn't imagine.
Old habits are hard to crack, she had said.
I wanted another shot at her, and I reached her by phone at the family house in Shaker Heights.
I had a chance to speak to Merrill shortly, I told her. I just need a few details cleared up.
You realize this is a very stressful time for my family, Inspector,
Hillary replied. We told you what we knew.
I didn't want to come on too strong. She had lost her sister in a horrible way. Her parents' home was filled with mourners and grief, and she was under no obligation to talk to me at all.
Merrill told me a few things about Kathy, her lifestyle.
We told you all that, she replied defensively. But we also told you that after meeting James, she had begun to settle down.
That's what I want to talk to you about. Merrill recalled there was someone she was seeing in San Francisco.
I thought we told you Kathy dated lots of men.
This one went on for a long time. He was older, married, some kind of big shot, possibly famous.
I wasn't my sister's keeper, Hillary complained.
I need a name, Miss Bloom. This man could be her killer.
I'm afraid I don't understand. I already told you what I know. My sister didn't exactly confide in me. We lived very different lives. I'm sure you've put two and two together already. There was a lot I didn't approve of.
You said something to me the first time we talked. Old habits are hard to crack.
What sort of habits were you referring to?
I'm afraid I don't know what you mean. The Cleveland police are handling this, Inspector. Can't we just let them do their job?
I'm trying to help you, Miss Bloom. Why did Kathy move away from San Francisco? I think you know. Was someone abusing her? Was Kathy in trouble?
Hillary sounded frightened.
I appreciate what you're trying to do, but I'm going to hang up now, Inspector.
It's going to come out, Hillary. It always does. An address book, her phone bill.
It's not just Kathy. There are four others back in California. They were just as hopeful about the rest of their lives as your sister. Just as deserving.
There was a tiny sob in her voice. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I felt I had one last chance.
Here's the really ugly truth about murder. If I've learned one thing as a homicide detective, it's that the lines don't stay fixed. Yesterday you were an innocent victim, but now you're in this too. This killer will strike again, and you will regret whatever you didn't tell me for the rest of your life.
There was a heavy silence on the line. I knew what it meant. It was the struggle inside Hillary Bloom's conscience. I heard a click. She had hung up the phone. Chapter 62 Our flight back to San Francisco left at 4 p.m. I hated to leave without a name, especially when I felt we were so close.
Somebody famous. Kinky. Why were they protecting him?
Anyway, we had accomplished a lot in just 2 days. It was clear to me that all three murders were committed by the same person. We had a strong lead tying him to San Francisco, a possible identity, a confirmed description. The trail was warm here and would grow ever hotter when we got home. Both investigations would proceed locally. Cleveland would contact the Seattle police force to do a search of the bride's home. Maybe something in her personal effects, an address book, an email in her computer, would divulge who her San Francisco lover was. Waiting to board our plane out of Cleveland, I called my voicemail for messages, one each from Cindy and Claire inquiring about my trip, our case. reporters pushing for comments on the Cleveland crime. Then I heard the throaty voice of Merrill shortly. She had left her California number. I punched the number as fast as I could. A housekeeper answered, and I could hear the wail of a baby crying. When Merrill got on, I could tell that some of her cool veneer had cracked. "I was thinking," she began, "there was something I didn't mention yesterday." "Yes, that's good to hear. This guy I told you about, the one Kathy was hooked up with in San Francisco, I was telling you the truth, I never knew his name."
"Okay, I hear you."
"But there were some things. I said he didn't treat her well. He was into intense sex games. Props, scenarios, maybe even a little filming. Problem was, Kathy liked the games."
There was a long pause before Merrill went on.
"Well, I think he pushed her, forced her to do more than she was comfortable with. I remember marks on her face, bruises on her legs. Mostly it was her spirit that was broken."
None of us were exactly bringing home Tom Cruise then, but there was a time when Kathy was real scared.
She was in his control.
I began to see where this was heading. "It's why she moved away, wasn't it?" I said. I could hear Merrill shortly sigh on the other end.
"Yes, it was."
"Then why did she continue to see him from Seattle? You said she was involved with him right up to the end."
"I never said," Merrill shortly replied, "that Kathy knew what was good for her."
Now I saw Kathy Kogut's life take on the shape of tragic inevitability. I was sure she had fled San Francisco, tried to break away from the grip of this man, but she couldn't break free. Was that true of the other murdered brides?
"I need a name, Miss Shortley. Whoever this was, he might have killed your friend. There are four others. The longer he's out there, the greater the chance he'll do it again."
"I told you I don't know his name, Inspector."
I raised my voice above the din in the terminal. "Merrill, someone must know. You knew her for years, partied together."
Merrill hesitated. "In her own way, Kathy was loyal. She said his name was well known, some kind of celebrity, someone I would know. She was protecting him, or maybe protecting herself."
My mind raced to the film and music business. She was into a bad scene. She was in over her head, and like many people who feel trapped, she ran. She just couldn't get far enough away.
"She must have told you something," I pressed. "What he did, where he lived, where they would meet. You guys were like sisters."
"Wicked sisters?"
"I swear, Inspector, I've been racking my brain."
"Then someone must know. Who? Tell me."
I heard Merrill shortly let out a mirthless laugh.
"Ask her sister."
Before we boarded, I beeped McBride and left a detailed message on his voicemail. Kathy's lover was probably someone famous. It was why she had moved away from San Francisco. The profile fit the pattern of our killer. Her sister, Hillary, might know the killer's name. On board, all I could think about was that we were getting close. Raleigh was there beside me. As the plane rose, I leaned into his arm, surrendering to total exhaustion. All my physical troubles seemed a million miles away. I remembered something I'd said to Claire. I had told her that finding this bastard gave me the resolve to go on. The red-bearded man in my dream who had gotten away. "We're going to get him," I said to Raleigh. "We can't let him kill another bride and groom." Chapter 63 8 the next morning, I was at my desk. There were several ways I could go with this investigation. Hillary Bloom was the most direct, assuming, as Merrill had implied, that she was able to give us a name. It was clear that, in a twisted way, she was trying to save her family the added pain of having Kathy publicly branded as some kind of pathetic sexual victim, cheating on her husband-to-be right up until their vows. Sooner or later, a name would emerge, from her or from Seattle. Before I did anything else, I called Medved's office and rescheduled the blood treatment I had canceled for 5 o'clock today. After a brief wait, the receptionist said the doctor would see me himself. Maybe it was good news. Truth was, I was feeling a little stronger. Maybe the treatments were beginning to do their work. It was hard picking up where I had left off in San Francisco. The best leads were now in Cleveland. I read some reports on the evidence Jacoby was tracking down, held a meeting of the task force at 10.
Actually, the most promising leads, the hair and the bridal boutique at Saks, had come from my meetings with Claire and Cindy. I couldn't resist calling Claire a little before noon.
"Bring me up to date," she said excitedly. "I thought we were partners."
"I will," I replied. "Get Cindy. Meet me for lunch."
Chapter 64. The three of us leaned against a stone wall in City Hall Park, picking at salad sandwiches we had bought at a nearby grocer's. The murder club meets again.
"You were right," I said to Claire. I passed her a copy of the security photo showing Redbeard sneaking into the Cleveland wedding. She stared at it, her eyes focusing intensely.
Claire looked up, only when the confirmation of her first physical supposition brought out a curious half-smile.
"I only read whatever that bastard left behind."
"Maybe," I said, tossing her a wink, "but I bet Rigetti would have missed it."
"This is true," she allowed with a satisfied beam.
It was a bright, breezy late June day. The air was fragrant from a crisp Pacific breeze. Office folk worked on their tans. Secretaries gabbed in groups.
I recounted what I had found in Cleveland. I never mentioned what had taken place by the lake between Chris Raleigh and me.
When I finished with Merrill Shortley's shocking revelation, Cindy said, "Maybe you should have stayed out there, Lindsay."
I shook my head.
"It's not my case. I was only there on a consult. Now I'm running point between three jurisdictions."
"You think Merrill Shortley has more to tell?" asked Claire.
"I don't think so. If she knew, I think she would have told me."
"The bride must have had other friends here," said Cindy. "She was in publicity. If this guy was famous, maybe she met him through her job."
I nodded.
"I have someone checking that out. We also have the Seattle PD combing through her apartment." "Where'd she work when she lived here?" Claire asked.
"An outfit called Bright Star Media. Apparently she was connected into the local music scene."
Cindy took a sip of iced tea.
"Why not let me have a go at it?"
"You mean like you did at the Hyatt?" I said.
She grinned.
"No, more like Napa. Come on, I'm a reporter. I sit all day with people trained to find the dirt on anybody."
I bit into my sandwich.
"Okay," I finally said. "Be my guest."
"In the meantime," Cindy inquired, "can I run with what we have so far?"
Much of it was classified. If it came out, it would point back to me.
"You can run with the similar pattern of murder in Cleveland. How we found the bodies, the bride's background here. Absolutely no mention of Merrill Shortley."
In that way, I hoped the killer would sense that we were closing in on him. It might cause him to think twice about killing again.
Cindy went over to a nearby ice cream cart to buy a gelato. Claire took the moment to ask,
"So, how are you feeling? You okay?"
I blew out a long breath and shrugged.
"Queasy, lightheaded. I was told to expect it. I'm having a blood treatment this afternoon. Medved said he'd be there."
I saw Cindy on her way back.
"Here," Cindy announced brightly. She was carrying three gelatos.
Claire clutched her chest and pretended she was going into cardiac arrest.
"I need gelato about as much as Texas needs a warm breeze in August."
"Me too," I laughed. But it was mango, and with the infection attacking me inside, it seemed like wasted caution to refuse.
Claire ended up taking hers, too.
"So, what you specifically haven't told us," she said with a slow roll of her tongue, "is what went on between you and Mr. Chris Raleigh in Ohio."
"'Cause there was nothing to tell," I said, and shrugged.
"One thing about cops," Cindy laughed, "is you would think they would learn how to lie."
"You're writing for Page Six now," I said, referring to the Chronicle's celebrity gossip section. Against my will, I felt my face blush. Claire and Cindy's greedy eyes bore down on me, driving home that it was pointless to resist. I pulled a knee up on the edge of the wall and sat yoga style. Then I took them through where things stood. The long, slow dance in my apartment, eliciting,
"You don't dance, girl," from Claire. "You cook."
I described the anticipation of sitting next to him on the plane, the nervous walk down by the lake, my own doubts, hesitation, the inner conflicts holding me back.
"Basically, it took every bit of self-control not to rip his clothes off right there on Lakefront Walk."
I laughed at how it must have sounded.
"Girl, why didn't you?" Claire said, wide-eyed. "Might have done you some good."
"I don't know," I said, shaking my head. but I did know. And though she tried to smile through it, Claire knew, too. She squeezed my hand. Cindy looked on, not knowing what was going on. Claire joked,
"I'd give up losing 20 pounds to see Cheery's expression if the two of you got picked up for going at it in the woods."
"Two San Francisco cops," announced Cindy in a newscaster tone, "in Cleveland in pursuit of the bride and groom killer were discovered au naturel in the bushes by the Cleveland waterfront."
The three of us choked with laughter, and it felt so good.
Cindy shrugged.
"That, Lindsay, I would have had to print."
"From now on," Claire giggled, "I can see things growing pretty humid in that squad car."
"I don't think that's Chris's style," I defended him. "You forget, the man's into the shipping news."
"Ooh, it's Chris now, huh?" mooned Claire. "And don't be so sure about that. Edmund plays three instruments, knows everything from Bartok to Keith Jarrett, but he's risen to the occasion in some very unexpected places."
"Like where?" I laughed, the surprise caught in my throat.
She coyly shook her head.
"I just don't want you thinking that because a man keeps himself with a certain dignity, there's any dignity when it comes to that."
"Come on," I exhorted. "You put it in play, let's hear."
"Let's just say that a few John Does aren't the only thing that have been stiff on our examining tables."
I almost fumbled my gelato onto the ground.
"You've got to be kidding. You? And Edmund?"
Claire's shoulders jiggled in delight.
"As long as I've gone this far. Once, we did it in a parterre box at the symphony. After a rehearsal, of course."
"What do you guys do? Just go around leaving your mark like poodles?" I exclaimed.
Claire's round face broadened with delight.
"You know, it was a long time ago. But as I think of it, that time in my office at the coroner's Christmas party, that wasn't so long ago."
"As long as we're bearing our souls," injected Cindy. "When I first got to the Chronicle, I had this fling with one of the senior guys from Arts and Letters. We used to meet down in the library, in the far reaches of the real estate section. Nobody ever went there."
Cindy scrunched her face, abashed, but Claire cackled with approval. I was amazed I was learning the hidden, suppressed side of a person I had known for 10 years. But there was a little shame building in me as well. I didn't have a story.
"So," Claire said, looking at me, "what's Inspector Boxer got to share from her closet?"
I tried to recall a single moment when I'd done something totally crazy. I mean, when it came to sex, I didn't think of myself as someone who held back. But somehow, no matter how hard I searched my memory, my passion always ended up between the sheets.
I shrugged, empty-handed.
"Well, you better get started," Claire said with a wag of her finger. "When I'm drawing my last breath, I won't be thinking about all those fancy degrees or conferences I spoke at. You only have a few times in your life to really cut loose, so you might as well take them when they come."
A little tremor of remorse knifed through me. At that moment, I didn't know what I wanted more. My place on the list, or a goddamn name for Redbeard. I suppose I wanted both.
Chapter 65. A couple of hours later, I sat in my hospital smock in the hematology clinic at Moffitt.
"Dr. Medved would like a word with you before we start," said Sarah, my transfusion nurse. I felt nervous as she unpacked an IV setup for my treatment. Truth was, I had been feeling okay. Not much pain or nausea, other than the incident in the ladies' room last week. Dr. Medved walked in with a manila folder under his arm. His face was friendly but unconfiding. I smiled weakly. "Only good news?" He sat across from me on the ledge of a counter.
"How are you feeling, Lindsay?"
"I wasn't feeling so bad when I saw you before."
"Fatigued?"
"Only a little. End of day kind of thing."
"Sudden nausea? Queasiness?"
I admitted I had vomited suddenly once or twice. He made a quick notation on a chart. He paged through some medical charts in the folder.
"I see we've undergone 4 packed red cell transfusions so far."
My heart was racing the longer he took. Finally, he put down the folder and he looked squarely at my face.
"I'm afraid your erythrocyte count has continued to decline,"
Lindsay. You can see the trend line here.
Medved passed me a sheet. Leaning forward, he took a cross pen out of his breast pocket. The paper had a computer graph on it. He traced the pattern with his pen. The line went steadily down.
Shit!
I felt the air rush out of my lungs with disappointment. I'm getting worse, I said.
To be frank, the doctor acknowledged, it's not the trend we were hoping for.
I had ignored the possibility that this might happen, burying myself in the case, sure that the numbers would improve. I had built this view on a natural trust that I was too young and energetic to be truly sick. I had work to do, important work, a life to live. I wasn't dying, was I? Oh, God.
What happens now?
I managed to say. My voice came out as a whisper.
I want to continue with the treatments, Medved replied. In fact, increase them. Sometimes these things take a while to kick in.
Super high test, I joked glumly. He nodded.
From this point on, I'd like you to come in 3 times a week. And I'm going to increase the dosage by 30%.
He shifted his weight off the counter.
In and of itself, there's no immediate cause for alarm, he declared in a marginally uplifting tone. You can continue to work. That is, if you feel up to it.
I have to work, I told Medved. Chapter 66. I drove home in a daze. One moment I was battling to unravel this damned case, and the next I was fighting for my life.
I wanted a name. I wanted it now more than ever. And I wanted my life back. I wanted a shot at the whole deal. Happiness, success, someone to share it with, a child. And now that I'd met Raleigh, I knew there was a chance that I could have these things. If I could hold out. If I could will good cells into my body.
I went into my apartment. Sweet Martha was all over me, so I took her for a short walk. But then I moped around, alternating between resolve to fight through this mess and sadness that I couldn't. I even contemplated making a meal. I thought it would calm me. I took out an onion and cut 2 desultory slices. Then I realized how crazy it all was. I needed to talk to someone. I wanted to shout, "I don't fucking deserve this!" And this time I wanted someone to hear it. I thought of Chris, his comforting arms around me, his eyes, his smile. I wished I could tell him. He would come in an instant. I could rest my head on his shoulder. I called Claire. She could tell from my first tremulous sound. She realized something was terribly wrong.
"I'm scared,"
was all I said. We talked for an hour on the phone. I talked. I went back and forth with Claire in a numbed state. Panicked by the impending nearness of Negley's next stage. I told Claire that nailing this bastard gave me the will to fight on. It separated me from being just another person who was sick. I had a special purpose.
"Has that changed for you, Lindsay?" she asked softly.
"No, I want to get him more than ever."
"Then that's what we're going to do. You, me, little Cindy. We're here to help you fight. We're your support, Lindsay. Just this one time, don't try to do it yourself."
In an hour, she had calmed me enough so we could say goodnight. I curled up on the couch. Martha and I snuggled under a blanket and watched the movie Dave, one of my favorites. When Sigourney Weaver visits Kevin Kline in his new campaign office at the end, it always makes me cry. I fell asleep, hoping for a happy ending in my own life. Chapter 67. The next morning, I went at it stronger than ever. I still believed we were close, maybe just hours from a name for Redbeard. I checked in with Roth's contact, Jim Heakin, on the Seattle Police Force. Heakin said they were sorting through the bride's possessions as we spoke. If something came up, he would let me know immediately. We got a reply back from Infortech, where Kathy Voskuhl had worked in Seattle. In the 3 years she had held her job, there was no record of any reimbursements for business trips to San Francisco. Her job was to work with developing clients in Seattle, a junior account manager. If she repeatedly went down there, she was on her own. Finally, I called McBride. The Kogutz were still claiming that they knew nothing more. But yesterday, he'd met with the father, who seemed ready to give in.
It was wrenching that some desperate attempt to hold together their daughter's virtue was clouding their judgment. Since I was a woman, McBride suggested, maybe one more try from me would push them over the edge. I placed a call to Christine Cogut, the bride's mother. When she came on, her voice was different, remote, but freer, as if she were in a less tormented state. Maybe, I just hoped, she was. "Your daughter's killer is running free," I said. I could no longer hold back. "Two other couples' families are suffering. I think you know who was hurting Kathy. Please, help me put him away." I heard her take in a long breath. When she spoke, grief and the release of shame trembled in her voice. "You raise a child, Inspector. You think she is always part of you. You love her so much, and you think there is always that part that will never go away." "I know," I said. I could feel she was teetering.
"She knew his name, didn't she?"
"She was this beautiful thing. She could make anyone love her. A free spirit. One day, we thought, another free spirit would shape her into the kind of person she was meant to be. We cultivated it with our children. My husband insists we always favorite Kathy. Maybe we helped bring it all on."
I didn't say a word. I knew what it was like to finally give up what you were holding inside you. I wanted to let her reach that point on her own.
"Do you have children, Inspector?"
"Not yet," I told her.
"It's so hard to believe. Your baby, the cause of so much pain. We begged her to break free. We even got her the new job. Moved her ourselves. We thought if she could only get away from him."
I was silent, letting her go at her own pace.
"She was sick. Like an addict is sick, Inspector. She couldn't stop herself. But what I don't understand is why he would hurt her so badly. He took away all that was pure about her. Why did he need to hurt Kathy?"
"Give me the name. Who is he?"
She was mesmerized by who he was. It was as if she had no self-control when it came to this man. She shamed us right up until the end. But even now, her voice lowered, I still wonder how someone who loved my daughter could possibly kill her. I'm afraid that I don't believe it. That's partly why I wouldn't tell you.
"Tell me now," I said.
"I think she met him at the opening of one of his films. He told her he had a face like hers in mind when he dreamed up one of his characters, his heroine."
It was then that Mrs. Cogut told me. My body went numb. I knew the name, recognized it. He was famous. Redbeard. Chapter 68. I sat there, ratcheting the possible connections through my mind. Things were starting to piece together. He was one of the minority partners at Sparrow Ridge Vineyards, where the second couple had been dumped. He had known Kathy Cogut for years in San Francisco, preyed on her. He was older, married, famous. By itself, the suspect's name proved nothing. He had merely known the last bride. He had a circumstantial connection to the crime scene of the second killings. But based on the descriptions of Merrill Shortley and Christine Cogut, he had the brutal temperament and maybe the motive to commit these vicious murders. The conviction built up inside me that this was Redbeard. I grabbed Raleigh.
"What's going on?" he asked. "Where's the fire?"
"I'm going to start one in here. Watch!" I dragged him into Roth's office.
"I have a name," I announced as I threw my fist in the air.
They looked at me in wide-eyed surprise.
"Nicholas Jenks." "The writer?"
Raleigh gaped. I nodded.
"He was Kathy Cogut's lover here in San Francisco. Her mother finally gave it up."
I walked them through the not-so-random connections he had with at least three of the victims.
"This guy's famous," blurted Roth. "He made those movies, blockbusters."
"That's exactly the point. Merrill Shortley said it was someone Kathy was trying to conceal. The guy's got two connections, Sam."
"He's got connections, all right," Roth cried. "Jenks and his wife are invited to all the big affairs. I've seen his picture with the mayor. Wasn't he part of the bid to keep the Giants here?"
The air in Cheery's office became heavy with the weight of dangerous possibilities and risk.
You should have heard how the Kogats described him, Sam, I said, like some kind of animal, a predator. I think we're going to find he had something going with all three girls.
I think Lindsay's right, Sam, Chris said.
We watched Roth slowly clicking effects in his head. Nicholas Jenks was famous, a national figure, untouchable. The lieutenant's face twisted as if he had swallowed a bad clam.
You've got nothing right now, he came back. All of it, it's beyond circumstantial.
His name has popped up in connection with four dead people. We could get face to face, like I would with anyone else. We could talk to the district attorney.
Roth held up a hand. Nicholas Jenks was one of San Francisco's most prominent citizens. Implicating him on a murder charge was dangerous.
We'd better be right.
I didn't know what Cheery was thinking. Finally, there was the slightest relaxation in his neck, only a tight swallow, but in Roth speak it was a go-ahead.
You could talk to the DA, he agreed. Call Jill Bernhardt.
He turned to Raleigh.
This can't get out until we have something really firm.
Unfortunately, Assistant District Attorney Jill Bernhardt was stuck in court. Her secretary said she wouldn't be out until the end of the day. Too bad. I knew Jill a little, liked her. She was tough, with dazzling smarts. She even had a conscience.
Raleigh and I got a cup of coffee, going over what we should do next. Roth was right. As far as a warrant was concerned, we had nothing. A direct confrontation could be dangerous. A guy like this, you had to be sure. He would fight back.
Warren Jacoby shuffled in, a self-satisfied smirk puffing up his face.
Must be raining champagne today, he muttered.
I took it as another sardonic zinger aimed at Raleigh and me.
For weeks, I can't even get a bite on this shit, he sat down and cocked his head toward Raleigh. Bite. Champagne. That works, Captain, doesn't it?
Works for me, Raleigh said. Jacoby continued.
So yesterday Jennings comes back with three places that had sold a few cases of the bubbly in question. One of the buyers is this accountant in San Mateo. Funny thing is, his name's on file. Ends up he did 2 years up in Lampoc for securities fraud. Kind of a reach, isn't it? Serial killing, securities fraud.
Maybe the guy's got a thing against people who file joint returns, I said, and smiled at Jacoby. He puckered up his face.
The second is some woman manager at 3Com who's stocking up for a 40th birthday bash. This Clos du Mesnil is a real collectible. It's French, I'm told.
I glanced up, waiting for him to get to the point.
Now, the third one. That's what I mean by reigning. Big auction house, Butterfield and Butterfield. 3 years back, sold 2 cases of the 89. Went for $2,500 per case, plus commission. Private collector. At first they wouldn't give out his name, but we squeezed. Turns out, he's a big shot. My wife, she happens to be a fan. Read every one of his books.
Raleigh and I froze. Who's Warren? I pressed.
I figure I check it out. I can be a hero. Bring home a signed copy. You ever read Lion's Share by Nicholas Jenks?
Chapter 69. Jacoby's statement felt like an elbow to my solar plexus. At the same time, it removed all doubt for me. Kathy Kogut, Sparrow Ridge, the Clos-du-Mesnil Champagne. Jenks was now tied in to all three murders. He was Redbeard. I wanted to run and confront Jenks, but I knew I couldn't. I wanted to get up close, glare in his smug eyes, let him know I knew. At the same time, a suffocating tightness swept up into my chest. I didn't know if it was a flash of nausea, Negley's, or the release of my bottled-up rage. Whatever it was, I knew I had to get out. I'm leaving, I said to Raleigh. I was scared. He looked stunned and confused as I rushed out.
Hey, I say something wrong, I heard Jacoby say.
I grabbed my jacket and purse and ran down the steps to the street. My blood was rioting inside me like an angry demon. A cold sweat had broken out all over me. I ran out into the cool day, started to walk fast down the street. I had no idea where I was going. I felt like a foreign tourist wandering in the city for the first time. Soon there were crowds, stores, people rushing by who knew nothing about me. I wanted to lose myself for a few minutes. Starbucks, Kinko's, Empress Travel, familiar names flashed by. I felt drawn by a single irrepressible urge. I wanted to look in his eyes. On Fifth, I found myself standing in front of a Borders bookshop. I went inside. It was large and